studying in 1 Peter, now chapter 3, and just to remind ourselves of the context of our study, let's do that review in the form of a pop quiz. I'm not going to hand out a piece of paper or anything for anybody, so you're safe. But question number one, from the context in 1 Peter, going back to chapter 2 and verse 13, what does the Lord say that Christians must do concerning governmental authority with every ordinance of man? We have to obey it, okay? With what exception? If it conflicts with God's law, we looked at that then. That would be, that's the case in with every authority arrangement, isn't it? But another question, why do we have to submit to the governmental authority? It's Jesus' authority, which that sums up really all of this. Who has all authority in heaven and in earth? Christ does, given to him by whom? The Father. When? On what day? Well, he gave him all authority in heaven and in earth when he gave him the heathen for his possession and the other, for his inheritance in the uttermost parts of the earth for his possession. That's in which psalm? Number 2. And that's when the Lord said unto me, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. So there was a particular day that was speaking of, which is quoted in the New Testament. And we even looked at Acts 13 where it names the psalm and clearly tells us that is which day? The day of Christ's resurrection. That's the day that the Father gave all authority to the Son. All authority to the Son. Why did he do that then? Well, is there a scripture that says, wherefore, for this reason, he gave him a name, authority, which is above every name, every authority, which would be all authority, wouldn't it? Wherefore, he gave him a name, which is above every name, that at his name we should all bow our knees and confess that authority that he has. Well, that's Philippians chapter 2, verse 9. And so what comes before that wherefore? What is the reason why the Father gave his Son all authority in heaven and on earth? Because of his obedience. He humbled himself and became obedient. How far? Unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore, his Father gave him that position. Can he trust his Son to have him next to him with all authority? Of course, we know from 1 Corinthians 15, the Father has accepted himself. That is with an E-X-C. He is an exception. He is not under the Son's authority. But the Son has been given all authority, not over the Father himself. But to give him all authority, does that require trust? Did the Father entrust the Son with that authority because he does trust the Son and how he would use that authority? And how does the Son use that authority? According to his Father's will. So does the Son exercise his authority according to his Father's will in all things? Yes. And how did the Father know he would do that? Well, when he sent him here to this earth under every temptation that he was under, what did he do in every single case? Yeah, he passed every test and never sinned against his Father to the point of going to the cross. And so that for that reason, he gave him all authority in heaven and in earth. And how many different aspects of the authority of Christ affect us In how many different ways are we under that authority? What's the first way that we come under that authority? On the day we're born. what aspect of Christ's authority are we under from day one? Well, yes. So we're looking at the applications or manifestations of the Creator's authority, and the first that starts day one is under our parents. So that's why children are to obey their parents in the Lord. It's His authority, the Creator's authority. So we have the authority of the parents in the home, so our families, and there's an authority arrangement in the home for children. And as we're seeing in the context of 1 Peter chapter 3, husbands and wives. So there's an authority arrangement there. We know that there's an authority arrangement whereby the Lord governs this world. And so we have laws in our land. So there are, from the top down, there's authority. There's organization to this world, isn't there? Without which, in fact, Brother Jan just prayed a moment ago and quoted from 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2 in his prayer. And we are to pray for the government, the authorities of the land, so that we can lead what kind of lives? Those quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty. And file that one away for just a moment, because there's a word in there that comes up here in 1 Peter chapter 3 concerning the kind of heart that that is of great price in God's sight. But we're to pray for the government, for the authorities, the governmental authorities, so that we can live those kinds of lives, which tells us if the Lord weren't ruling through them, I mean, what would it be like out there? I mean, it seems pretty wild as it is sometimes, doesn't it? I mean, people, if they had no restraint, if there was no structure, if there was no authority, no enforcement of laws, no laws or no enforcement of the laws, I mean, how could we, what would it be like? It would be bedlam. That's exactly what it would be like. It would be utter bedlam. So the Lord has things under His control, doesn't He? And so we've got governmental authority, we have authority in the home, we have an authority arrangement in the church. What is another major part of our lives that we have to deal with authority? What do most of us have to do at least 40 hours a week? Yeah, I mean, is there authority for that part of our lives, for when we have to work? Yes, and that, of course, is dealt with in 1 Peter chapter 2 also, as he was dealing with servants and their masters. So we have earthly masters in our jobs. But what is consistent with every one of these points of authority? It's Christ's authority, but in each one of them, what does He say that we have to do? Yeah, we have to submit to that authority and obey the ones that have the authority, because that is a way in which we are submitting to Christ and obeying Him, because it's His authority. There's no authority that's not under Him. So you did a great job on the pop quiz. So everybody gets 100. Now when we're in chapter 3, so chapter 2 dealt with the application starting in verse 13 with being in subjection to governmental authority. Then in verse 18 with that authority that is covers our vocation, of course, with a slave. There's no clocking out of that, but another point that's through all of this that ties into really the main subject of this book of 1 Peter. I mean, what's the subject that we see in every single chapter dealt with at length? What's that? Temptation, suffering, temptation. So how does that tie into this these authority arrangements that we have over us? Well, the ones that exercise that authority, if they are followers of Christ, how would they exercise that authority? At least should. I mean, righteously, according to what Christ teaches. Is that what always happens? Do those who possess authority ever misuse that authority and, in fact, persecute Christians with that authority? Does that happen? It does. In each of these cases, and that's one of the subjects or the tie-in to the main subject that we see here. So as we saw the example back in chapter 2, verse 18, servants are to be subject to their masters with all fear as long as they treat them well. That's not what he says, is it? Not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward. And and what does froward mean? What, crooked, twisted? What's that? You remember that Greek word that's there, scolios? So that's a word I think a few of us know. Some people have it in their back, their spine. That's the kind of person that he's talking about there. So here's somebody that has authority over this servant, and they're mistreating them with that authority. And really, in this context, particularly because they are a follower of Christ, does that remove the obligation to be in subjection to that authority? No, because whose authority is it? It remains Christ's authority. So how the one that is under Christ with that authority is using it, are they going to answer to Christ for how they did that? Yes, they will. And any of us that have authority under Christ in any way will have to answer to him for that. And that's why he teaches Christians how to righteously use authority. So whether that's as a father, husband, or whether it's a mother over the children, if one happens to have governmental authority, if one is in a position of some kind of a boss at work, I mean, there are lots of ways in which we could be in a position of authority, elders in the church. If we are in one of those positions, then we have to use that as Christ has taught. So those who have it are going to answer to him for how they use it. But there's no pass given or exception given to where we don't have to submit to the authority if they're persecuting us. The lone exception, as we mentioned and we've looked at before, anytime if somebody's telling us to disobey Christ, well, then they're not using Christ's authority there. They're using their own authority, which there is none. So we always must obey the Lord over man in a situation like that. But he's not talking about that one exception here. But these are ones that are under someone who's persecuting them. We saw what he taught there. And right after verse 18 in chapter 2, all the way down to the end of the chapter, whose footsteps did he give as an example that we're to follow? And that's Christ. And that is in enduring grief, suffering wrongfully. So when you're a Christian and you're doing what's right, and then somebody is against you for that reason and then is persecuting you with their authority for it. Well, Christ went through that and he did his Father's will through it fully, as he showed us there with his footsteps in doing no sin, no guile in his mouth, did not revile back when he was reviled. He didn't threaten when he was suffering at their hands. He committed himself to the one who judges righteously, to his Father, as we're told also to do. In fact, when we get to the end of chapter 4, it's almost identical words. We are to commit our souls to our faithful creator, as Jesus trusted his Father. And so in the case of chapter 3, then, the application that we're looking at is here in verses 1 through 6. Christian women who are under whose authority? Their husbands. And in this particular context, as he begins verse 1 with the word likewise that we pointed out, that ties it back to what he's already, really going back to chapter 2, verse 18, what he said to servants and their masters. In the same way, wives are to be in subjection to their own husbands, only to the good and gentle, or also to the froward. Now, there's only one way in which a Christian woman should have a froward husband. If he's a Christian and he's a froward master at home, is he following Christ properly? No. So he's not walking in the steps of Christ then. So he's wayward or astray if he's a Christian and treating his wife like that. But, I mean, what Christian husband is going to be persecuting his wife because she's a Christian? Well, and he's very clear in this context. Is this someone who's obeyed the gospel, or is this somebody who's not yet obeyed it? He's talking about a non-Christian husband here. And as we pointed out, the way in which you would have a marriage of a Christian to a non-Christian, the only way that should come about is if they're married when they're both outside of Christ, and then one is converted to Christ, well, the other isn't yet. But he shows that this is a way in which a Christian woman can win her husband to Christ, which is a major point of this, by being very good at preaching at him every day when he arrives home from work and hounding him until he goes to bed, and then from when he gets up the next, is that what he says? Or is it actually the opposite? Does it say without the word? And so then in what way? By behavior, that example. Can he be won to Christ by the behavior of his Christian wife? Yes. Why might a man whose wife becomes a Christian start persecuting her for that? Yeah. And that's what sometimes that happens, and sometimes a husband might get mad because his wife has done this. He doesn't agree with it or doesn't believe what she does and doesn't like. I mean, what are all the changes that take place? And we're going to see that in the beginning of chapter 4 also. Anyone that, when we were running with those ones that weren't Christians and we weren't living the life of a Christian, and then we change and we're converted to Christ, those ones that we're leaving behind in that sense, where our behavior is totally changed now, what do they think of us? He's going to say, well, they think it's strange that we don't run with them in doing those things anymore. Well, what about this Christian man? Now his wife's converted to Christ. Everything that he was used to before, it's all different now, isn't it? She's different. Does every man take that well? No. And what's one of the ways he might respond to that? I mean, going after her, persecuting her because of her conversion to Christ. What is she supposed to do then? Rebel? Does she say, well, if he's going to treat her like that, she doesn't have to submit to him? That's not what the Lord says. He says, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may, without the word, be won by the conversation, the behavior of the wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear. And so we looked at that last week noted that word chaste there, hagnos, which is a word for pure, and it's typically translated pure in the New Testament. So there's a purity of behavior and this fear of the Lord. Now, is this only for Christian women to be to have purity and fear the Lord, or is this all Christians are supposed to be like that? But here in this case, particularly this Christian woman is to exhibit that kind of behavior because of the opportunity to win her husband to Christ. Well, that's what she needs to do. Now, for that behavior to be pure and with the fear of the Lord, what has to be behind that? Where does behavior come from? Yes. So this is not putting on a pretense or just doing something to act a certain way. This is behavior that's going to be produced from a heart, which he's going to be very clear with when we get to verse 4. Verse 3, and we have already looked at a comparison with 1 Timothy chapter 2, 8 through 15. We read those verses last time too, but there's very similar, but he says, who's adorning? And it's the word for decoration in 1 Timothy 2. Here, the word adorning is actually the Greek word cosmos. It's kind of interesting. When we think of the cosmos, what are we thinking of? The universe. What's the actual, and that is very often, it's the world. That's usually how cosmos is translated, but not here, because that's not what he's talking about. But what is the word, what is the actual meaning of cosmos? It's an orderly arrangement. Well, what describes, and we, I know Brother Jan pointed this out with that word in our Christian Evidences study that we went through. But how does that apply to the universe that God made? Is there an orderly arrangement to all the creation? Yes, and so that's a very appropriate word to use. It's a descriptive term for what this world and this universe is that we live in. In this case, he's talking about the orderly arrangement, not of what we would say is the world, but of this woman, her orderly arrangement. What is the orderly arrangement of a Christian woman to be, and what is it not to be? I mean, here we have a contrast. So he says, who's adorning, let it not be. And then we get to verse 4, he's going to say, but let it be thee. So orderly arrangement is not to be first, and then he's going to say what it is supposed to be. And what is it not to be? Well, what's the key word there right after he says, let it not be that outward? When we get to verse 4, he's going to say, but let it be the hidden. He's not going to use the word inner, which is the opposite of outward, but it fits. I mean, he uses the word hidden. Well, what is the inner as compared to the outward? The outward is what is seen. It's the physical. The inward is what is not seen. And therefore, I mean, that's the word, main word for what is secret. But it's hidden, it's unseen, because it's inward. And he's pointing out this is the invisible part of us, which is therefore, if it's unseen, hidden from what is physical or the outward, then what is it in terms of its duration? Eternal. So we have what is outward, what is temporal, what is inward, what is eternal. And so we have the outer man or the inner man, the outer woman, the inner woman in this case. We understand what he's speaking about there, but he says, let it not be that outward. So the orderly arrangement, so there's a choice there of where the attention is going to be, where the emphasis is going to be. Now, does he say ignore your outward appearance and have no regard for the way that the way you appear to others? Where's that in the Bible? It's not. In fact, we've already seen that back in chapter 2 when he was telling us to have our behavior, verse 12 of chapter 2, to have our behavior honest among the Gentiles. That word honest, kalos, is the word for good in the sense of its appearance. Do we need to consider what appears to even these of the world? Now, are they going to, people of the world, the spiritual Gentiles, going to have spiritual sight? Are they going to be able to see spiritually? No, because they're of the world. Do we have to? And there's a reason why he uses that word. I mean, agathos is the word good as far as what is actually good. That would be what is the spiritual quality that would be invisible to those who are spiritually blind. But what they're going to see, the appearance. They're not going to discern the heart that's behind it, but they will certainly be able to see certain things. And do we have to consider the way we present ourselves to those that are in the world? Yes, and we do. So if we go out and our appearance, I know probably some of you wake up and you're already, your hair is, you don't need to do a thing with it when as soon as you get out of bed. I'm not like that. Mine is always pretty much straight up. I mean, well, in certain places and other angles, other places. I mean, I can't get up and go out like that. Some people look like they do, but we notice that, and that's not well appreciated, is it? And we don't want to go and try to do everything that's going to, well, the people in the world comb their hair, so therefore we're not. I mean, that's not the way a Christian is supposed to think. I mean, it's we don't want to go out there and draw attention to ourselves because of how homely we've made ourselves look on purpose. So yes, we need to have a neat appearance, but is that where our emphasis is? Is that what our orderly arrangement is focused upon? No. And that's what he says here, not that. And then he says, gives examples of that, plaiting hair and the wearing of gold and putting on of apparel. So those are all, I mean, the hair, the jewelry, the outfit. I mean, those are all parts of what's on the outside. Now, do some women, is that what their attention is on? Is that what their focus is on as far as how they're arranging themselves, is what they look like physically? With all those things, hair, jewelry, clothing, yes, that, and we know that's, and some guys are that way too, but for a Christian, that should not be what we are orderly arranging. That's the part of us that we are concerned with. Well, that's where we're trying. Is she going to win him over by, if she gets, and if she gets the nicest clothes, the best of all these outer things? It's not to say she shouldn't look nice for a husband, but I mean, this is not the area that she's supposed to be having her orderly arrangement of. That's not what's going to win him to Christ. What is? Well, verse 4. And we noted that's not a list of rules that a Christian woman is not to plait her hair. So, I mean, don't do any arrangement of your hair. Or no jewelry. Is that what he's saying? Well, no, because then what's the next thing? Putting on of apparel. You can see where the problem is if somebody's trying to make that to be, well, this is a rule, don't do this at all. But that's not what the orderly arrangement is to be with those outward things. It's to be, in verse 4, the hidden man of the heart. So a Christian woman should be focused on what? Just like, not just a Christian woman, all of us. Not the outer man, but the inner man. And in her case here in verse 4, but let it be the hidden man of the heart. Well, if he's going to behold her chaste behavior coupled with fear and might be won by that behavior, what we saw in verses 1 and 2, what is she going to have? Where's that behavior going to come from? So he's going to go right to the source. So it's the heart, the spiritual heart. So that hidden man, that secret, the unseen part. And how does he describe it there, that hidden man of the heart? In that which is not corruptible. So if a Christian woman's way of dealing with her non-Christian husband is by how she's going to, all these things she's going to do with the outside. Well, what's the problem with that? Is that corruptible or incorruptible? It's corruptible. It's physical. It's outward. But that hidden man of the heart, that's spiritual, that's incorruptible. Which means how long does it last? It's eternal. These words are so similar here to what we read in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 18, which we really want to look at 16 to 18 as we have probably 1,000 at least times. But this is good. These are words that we all should know. It's very vital for us to be able to discern between the outer and the inner part of us, and then to see that inner, and that's what we're looking at, those things that are eternal and not the things that are temporal. So 2 Corinthians 4, 16 through 18, once again, he says, "For which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day." So there again, the outer man and the inner man. Is that similar to what he's talking about? Is that exactly what he's talking about there in this part of 1 Peter chapter 3? Yes. And then he says in verse 17, "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." What should we be looking at? Which is the same point he's making there for Christian wives in this situation that they're in with their husbands when they are when they're facing persecution and mistreatment because they are following Christ and their husband is not yet. He may never, but he might. And the way that he can be won is by this this pure behavior coupled with fear, this fear of the Lord. But that's going to come from this heart that she has. That let it be that hidden man of the heart, back in 1 Peter 3, 4, in that which is not corruptible. And he says, even the ornament, we see italics there, really supplied for making the reading, because he is talking about, I mean, he uses that word adorning at the beginning of verse 3, cosmos. So that is what he's talking about. But that which is not corruptible, he says that with even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit. So there's some words to describe what is to be in the heart of this this woman, in any Christian woman, I think we should all be able to recognize these, especially when we look at this. These are qualities not only for. Is there any quality that God teaches that a Christian woman needs to have in her heart that He does, that He teaches a Christian man that he doesn't need that? Is there any, if it's something we should have, I mean, it's a part of whose nature, whose heart? If we're to have a certain kind of heart, whose heart are we to have? So what Christian woman is going to have something in her heart that's of the heart of God that a Christian man doesn't need? Yeah, we need to be complete in all of these things, all of us. But this is a particular situation when a Christian woman has that kind of heart, and then the behavior is produced from the good treasure of that heart. This is what is to be on display. This is what is to be orderly arranged to her husband, and he may be won by that. But here he emphasizes a meek and quiet spirit. That word meek, praus is the Greek word there. Literally it means mild. Well, when you, and then think of the context, let's just not lose sight of that. Here she has a husband, not a believer, not treating her right. In fact, she's even being persecuted because she's a Christian, and she's to respond with meekness. Is that easy? If somebody has authority over us, in fact, I mean, this translates to all those other applications that we've looked at, too. I mean, this—if we're under authority and somebody's misusing it, we're supposed to respond or deal with that with meekness. That is not—it's not easy. I don't know if it's not easy for. Not easy for me. I don't think it's very easy for anybody. This is not naturally what people do. I mean, what do people naturally do when they're being mistreated? Not to respond with being mild, but what? Somebody does something to you, what do? Yeah, you stop them from doing it again. Respond in kind. Not with kindness, but this is what people, who would respond to a persecutor with meekness, submitting willingly to that authority that's being misused, used against them? Only a Christian would do that. This is really one of the main things that distinguish us from the world. I mean, when we look at, if we can turn to Matthew chapter 5 and remind ourselves of that again, and this is the heart of God that we're to have in us, and this is this part of His love, dealing with our enemies and our persecutors. He says in verse 43, Matthew 5:43, you've heard that it has been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy, but I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Well, what if that persecutor also has authority over you? Still have to love them, still have to do good, and in this case respond, deal with that authority by being meek, submitting to it meekly. Is this what anybody in the world does? No. He said, but we have to do that, he says in verse 45, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. And so is this one of the things that distinguishes a child of God from someone who's not? I mean, this is one of the key differences between somebody who's following God and someone who isn't. And he shows us this is the heart of God himself. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. Is God only good to those who love him in return, or does he do good to his enemies? More than any being, by far. And then he says in verse 46, for if you love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? So if we are nice to people who are nice to us, I mean, how are we different from anybody else, really? But who is going to do good to, and in the context that we're studying about, who's going to submit to the authority of a persecutor with meekness, except one who's following God? that's got the heart of Christ. So this is a major way in which that light can shine. Only a Christian would do that. So a husband that has a wife doing that, he has something that nobody else does, except for who might also be married to a follower of Christ. So she's not doing the things that maybe they did before when she wasn't a Christian. Some of the ways in which maybe they were enjoying the pleasures of this life. There's going to be things she's not doing anymore, but who wouldn't appreciate somebody that treats them with meekness? I mean, everybody would. I mean, how hard would your heart have to be treated? You're abusing somebody and all they do is respond with meekness to you. You'd have to be very cruel to keep doing that and keep doing that when all you're getting back is meekness and kindness and humility and just continue to persecute them. Is somebody's heart eventually going to be won to that good behavior? Well, that's what he says can happen. I mean, are there some real cruel ones out there? Well, there are. And that would be a very hard situation for anybody under authority. But it may happen, and the authority is still there. So here's what the Lord calls a Christian to do, in this case a Christian woman in this situation. But meekness, that word that he uses there, it's used by Christ earlier in chapter 5. We were reading the end of chapter 5, which is the first chapter of the three chapters that contain the Sermon on the Mount. Well, what is the fifth verse of chapter 5? What did Jesus say? Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. That's the word. So the Lord teaches us to have that very quality, and he's using that same word there. Well, when he's teaching his followers to have that kind of heart, what kind of heart does he have? Well, the prophecy of Christ entering the city of Jerusalem, riding on the donkey, that goes back to was prophesied by Zechariah. But that prophecy of Christ spoke of his or foretold the very nature that he had, the kind of heart that he had. Matthew chapter 21 and verse 5. Matthew 21 verse 5. He says, "Tell you the daughter of Zion, behold, thy king cometh unto thee, meek, and sitting upon an ass and a colt, the foal of an ass." So he's coming meek. I mean, there are many words that could have been chosen by the Lord just to describe his son and his nature, and he's all of those things that are has all of those parts of his father's love and has shown that to us. But it's interesting that is the word right there. It's that same word here, praus, that he uses to describe Christ and his nature. Well, in Matthew 11, verse 29, there's a form of the very same word. It's praos in this case, but it's same word, same meaning. But Matthew 11, 29, and I know we've all heard this one too, but he says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls." So this is the nature of Christ. He's meek and humble. Who of us are supposed to be like him? All of us. But for a Christian woman with a non-Christian husband in this case, and she's being under persecution, and she's supposed to be just showing that meekness, that humility in submitting herself to that authority in spite of the mistreatment. Word meek is used there, and then he says, "and quiet," a meek and quiet spirit. That's a word that's only used a couple times in the New Testament. That That word quiet there, it's kind of interesting. Hesukios is the Greek word. It's 2272 in Strong's, if you want that. The other place it's used is in 1 Timothy 2, verse 2, where it's translated peaceable. The word actually means keeping one's seat. So it's a word that's more of a descriptive type of word. It's describing really a posture, but there's a kind of heart that's behind that posture. I mean, when we look at the context here, so she's to have a meek spirit and a keeping one's seat spirit. Well, here's a man that has authority over her and he's mistreating her. So what is she doing? She's sitting there meekly, enduring it. What's the other way to not keep one's seat? What would the opposite be? Stand up and fight. I mean, it's true, isn't it? I mean, it's one or the other. So is she supposed to stand up and fight for her rights? And is that the way to handle this? But this would not be easy. And this, again, would be all of us in any situation like that when we're under authority and we're being persecuted. We have to endure it, walking in the steps of Christ. And we need to have that meekness, and we're not to be out there fighting against it. I mean, when Jesus was taken, did he resist? Did he try to fight him? Peter did. And what did Jesus tell him? Yeah, put that away. Don't do that. That's not the approach we need to take. So here she is. It's showing that meekness and that humility. So she's going to keep her seat in the face of this, this mistreatment. Whatever he might think about it, I mean, obviously he mentions in verse 1 that he may be won by that behavior, and that would be the hope and the prayer for her and anybody else that would know him that's a Christian. But if he's not converted, well, one thing we know that he already mentioned in the previous chapter, in chapter 2, verse 12, if nothing else, what's he going to end up doing on the day of visitation? Even if he's never converted, even if he doesn't appreciate what he has with this woman that's now a follower of Christ and the behavior she's showing towards him, even if he never appreciates that, never responds, never converts to Christ, what's he going to end up doing on the day of visitation? He's going to be glorifying God for the good works that he saw her do. So God is going to be glorified by what she's doing. So even if he doesn't appreciate it, even if in his sight this meekness and humility and the subjection that she's showing to him, even if he despises that, disdains that, what does he say there at the end of verse 4? In the sight of God, it is of great price. And I mentioned that that's in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, where it's translated peaceable. We all want to live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty. And so that word peaceable there is keeping our seats. We'd like to be able to do that, where we can sit down and not be out there having to deal with problems because of the governmental authorities, but what others might be doing without that that authority being exercised to keep order. So when we can keep our seats and be orderly and live our lives as Christians, that's a good thing. But we can see the context here in 1 Peter 3, verse 4 for this Christian woman. But this is in the sight of God of great price. That means extremely expensive. So that word much, it's a compound word. Interestingly, polluteles. The last part is the form. It's telos is which is the word. That's where teleos, which is complete. And the first part really means much. So it's talking about much in terms of price. So it's completely expensive. That's really what it means. They're completely pricey. That's what the compound word. It's kind of interesting what's in there. But it shows the value of this kind of heart or spirit in God's sight. It's not just a little bit valued by God. It's in His sight of great price, great, that part of the, so we have great price, two separate words. It's one compound word there in Greek, but what correlates to the great part is actually telos. So this is God's view of it, and that's the view that we need to have. And obviously those Christian women who are married to Christian men, the way it should be, and for those of us who are husbands and have Christian wives, in following Christ and having that kind of spirit and seeing what God, how God sees her and what, how valuable that is to Him, what should it be to us? Yeah, it should be, that should be of great price to us too. We should be very appreciative of having somebody that has that kind of heart. I mean, we should thank the Lord if we have somebody that has that kind of meekness and gentleness and humility, all the things that a follower of Christ should have, and dealing with the authority that we have in the home in subjection in that way. If we're blessed to have that, then it should be of in our sight of great price too. Because what is of great price in God's sight? Shouldn't it be of great price in our sight too? Most certainly. So that's not something we should just, and we need to think about that, because when you're with somebody day to day, we might find ourselves not really thinking about who that other person is and really how blessed we are to have that person, and think about those parts of the heart of Christ that we're benefiting from by that treatment that we receive from that good heart. So we need to be very appreciative of that and thank the Lord for it, and show that in the way we treat her. That's going to come up in verse 7 too. But he's going to then in verse 5 now give the example, because it might be that a Christian woman in that is like, she might be thinking, well, how can I do that? Or nobody's ever had to live with this guy or anybody like this. are there any, and we can all think about that in whatever type of circumstance we're in when we're suffering for righteousness' sake. And it's very easy for us to think about, well, nobody's ever had to go through something like I am right now. But is that true? If we start thinking like that, is that really accurate? When we get to the next chapter in verse 12 of chapter 4, what does he say? Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened unto you. So are we tempted to think that way? Yeah, we can get very down about our circumstances and think, well, I'm almost Job, but we're not. And there's nothing that we're going through that many others of our brethren have not also gone through, maybe going through now also, but there's no strange thing that's unique to any of us. These are all common to followers of Christ. It happened to Christ, it's going to happen to us, and not just any one of us individually, but these are things we're all going to have to go through in some way. So whatever our suffering is or temptation is, it's not unique to us. And what is an encouragement for us? in that? I mean, is it encouraging to us to know and be aware that others, many others who have followed the Lord, have also faced these things? Yes. And when he teaches us, for example, in the beginning of Hebrews chapter 12, and I know we're just about out of time, or we are out of time, but anyway, the beginning of Hebrews chapter 12, when he's teaching us to run with patience the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, and in so doing, we're laying aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. What is before he tells us to do that, what does he spend an entire chapter doing? Giving us that great cloud of witnesses that surround us. He reminds us of all these other examples of faith and obedience to God. By their faith, they obeyed the Lord and followed him. So he starts it with all of that, and so we have an entire lengthy chapter, Hebrews 11, about that, and then it leads into what he's teaching us to do. Well, does it encourage us to have all those examples of faith in the scriptures that we can look at? Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, who's mentioned in Hebrews 11, and who's he going to use by name, especially for Christian women here in these next couple of verses? Sarah. So, are Christian women to be encouraged by other godly women that we read about in Scripture who follow the Lord and were in subjection to their husbands? That's going to be very encouraging, as good examples are to all of us. So, that's what's coming next. We don't have time to start delving into verses 5 and 6, but Lord willing, next week we will look at that. Continue on with our study here in 1 Peter chapter 3.